Friday, April 16th, 2410. Disputed Space, Coreward of Klingi Prime, Klingon Union. Second Lieutenant Klamach was bored. This often happened around the halfway point of the third watch, when, under normal operating parameters, he was likely to be the only person awake on the entire ship. With a complement of only 12, a Koloth-class bird of prey like the Hwacha couldn't operate with a full crew at all times. On the other hand, on a ship this small, no one slept more than a few feet from his or her battle station, so having virtually the whole crew off shift at a particular time wasn't such a significant tactical advantage, and more so because exactly when those times were varied, since the ship's watch schedule did not match the length of a calendar day, so the enemy was unlikely to know when the ship's most vulnerable times would be. This tended to be very disorienting for some crew members when Klingon forces' ships returned to port, but in space it hardly mattered. Right now, for instance, back in the great city on Klingi Prime, where the 7th Fleet's master clock was situated, it was 3:32 in the afternoon, a Friday. People in regular office jobs would be looking out their windows, daydreaming about the impending weekend. Klamach, on the other hand, was sitting at his station on the empty bridge of the Hwacha, wishing something would happen. He was surprised to hear the whine of the power door behind him. His relief wasn't due for hours yet, and only very rarely did anyone visit the bridge during third watch. He swiveled in the center seat and was further surprised to see that the person who had just entered was Commander Jurdak. The captain never came to the bridge before the start of first watch. Ever. Even in an emergency. If, for instance, they unexpectedly encountered a Klavarite squadron, he would give the order to avoid them via the intercom. "Captain," said Klamach, rising hastily. A number of questions rattled through his head as follow-ups, but he couldn't actually ask any of them. The second lieutenant couldn't very well require an explanation of why the captain of the ship had deigned to visit his bridge, after all, or assume that there must be some extreme contingency in effect for the man to show his face there a millisecond before he had to. "Report," said Jurdak sharply. "What is our current position and vector?" Klamach felt a twinge of pride that he was able to provide that information without consulting his instruments, in spite of the fact that the captain had arrived unexpectedly to demand it of him. He was disappointed, but not surprised, to see that Jurdak didn't seem impressed. The captain merely nodded, then said brusquely, "Change of route. Make your course 247 Mark 25 Absolute and increase to warp factor 7. Action." "Acting," Klamach replied automatically, as he descended from the command dais to the helm station. Once there, he made the course alteration as instructed, then noted the change in the navigational plot which resulted and turned a startled look to Jurdak. "My lord," he said hesitantly, "this course change will take us into Klavarite space within the hour." "Yes," Jurdak replied, nodding. "That sector is very heavily patrolled," Klamach went on. "If we enter it at warp, our detection is a virtual certainty." "I know," Jurdak agreed. "Which makes me wonder," he added conversationally, "why my normally steady and reliable second officer chose to take such a rash and careless action." His broad, ugly face creased in a smile that did not improve it. "It's almost as if he wanted this ship to be captured or destroyed." Klamach gave the captain a look of utter bafflement, unable to parse his meaning even a little. "Sir, he said, but got no further before Jurdak produced a disruptor and shot him. "I have a message from another time. A Reproductions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a Duelist Opera. Technical Difficulties, by Benjamin D. Hutchins," hi, that's me, "and Matt Wagner." On the lowermost deck, and about as far abaft the bridge as a person could get and still be breathing, the ship's third lieutenant, out of five, was also awake. Battle engineer Velana O'Brien wasn't scheduled to be on duty right now. As the ship's one and only engineering officer, she had the first watch, along with the rest of the senior staff. At this hour, according to the duty roster, she should be asleep. In practice, though, she was often unable to sleep, and when that happened, she found it much more productive to go and get some work done than to lie in her rack looking at the ceiling. Besides, third watch was quiet, peaceful, or at least as peaceful as things ever got aboard a Klingon warship. Also, the Jeffries tubes were a better refuge than her quarters any day. The Klingon forces didn't call them that, of course. They were maintenance conduits. But Belana had been trained by an Earthman, and to her they would always be named for the long-dead patron saint of human starship engineers. Like everybody aboard apart from the captain, she was not entitled to a cabin door with a lock that was under her control, so even when she could get to sleep, there was no guarantee that she would be permitted to stay that way. The J-tubes, on the other hand, were strictly off-limits to the non-engineering ratings, and even the 4th and 5th lieutenants, which was handy, since the 5th lieutenant, Weapons Officer Vokan, was among the most likely to think that triggering the fire suppression system in her quarters, or turning her out of her bunk to answer a challenge to what he perceived as her undeserved seniority, was fine sport. It wasn't unusual for her to end up getting what sleep she got on any given day in one of the restricted engineering spaces instead. This was not in accordance with regulations, but since it kept the ship's engineer relatively sane, and often meant that she did more than her allotted quantity of work in a day, First Officer Carradus was generally inclined to view it as a win for the forces and let her be. Commander Jerdak would probably not have approved, but he never bothered himself with what went on in the engineering spaces. He was of the old school, a throwback to a time when captains cared nothing about the technical staff that kept the ship working so long as it never failed to work. That was fine with Belana. Monday, March 15th, 2410. Commander Jerdak looked up from his dinner and scowled at Subcommander Kratak. "What do you want?" he said. Seeing the small figure standing next to the general's adjutant, he scowled still more, his bushy eyebrows colliding, and then inquired acidly, "What's this? Has the Chancellor decided to include Bring Your Daughter to Work Day among the human traditions we're now expected to embrace?" "General Thalak's compliments," said Kratak with the imperturbable calm of a man who knows his position makes him untouchable by common, everyday officers, regardless of their relative ranks. "He has found you a replacement for Battle Engineer Pimav." Jerdak's scowl became a thing of legend. "Is this Zarg's idea of a joke?" he demanded. Kratak smiled thinly. "General Thalak doesn't have an idea of a joke," he replied. Jerdak surged to his feet, his great bulk moving more swiftly and easily than the sight of him implied. Standing, he was a good 2 feet taller than the figure next to Kratak, slim and slight, in spite of her armored uniform. But though she had to tilt her head back some way to do it, she looked him in the eye without evident fear as he glowered down at her. "What am I expected to do with this?" the commander wanted to know, his voice precisely calibrated so that everyone in the Bird of Prey's mess hall would hear it clearly. "It's too small and fragile to be of any use in battle, and too young to know the machinery. If I were putting together a Klingjak Kinta team, it might do for a Swift, but only if we were playing against Ferengi." Most of the others in the mess hall laughed raucously at that. Standing next to Kratak with her jaw set and her back straight, Belana glanced quickly but incisively around the room, taking note of the few who didn't. Of that handful, most were watching the situation unfold too intently to find it amusing, and one, the hulking figure in the far corner, was paying no attention at all. He was facing away from the captain's table and appeared to be reading something. "The one doubts my assessment of the candidate's skills?" Kratak inquired, his voice cool and pleasant. "Perhaps the one will inform General Thalak of his reservations regarding the efficiency of his chief of staff." The laughter stopped suddenly at that, as if someone had fired a warning shot into the ceiling. Subcommander Kratak was always calm, always collected, never raising his voice. A few around the 7th Fleet whispered that he might have a little bit of Vulcan in him, but he was far more dangerous than a Vulcan, so perhaps the calmer, deadlier kind of Rom. Now his deceptively pleasant tone even penetrated Jerdak's bluster. His broad, scarred face graying slightly, the commander growled and seated himself again, then gestured to one of his subordinates and said, "Vokan, see if it can defend itself with those tiny hands." B'Elanna won that fight, as she had won every one of the 4 subsequent fights Vokan had picked with her since that day. Her victory on the first day earned her not only a place on the skeptical commander's crew, but the weapons officer's seniority as well, which was why she was 3rd lieutenant and he was 5th, and presumably why he disliked her so extravagantly. Interestingly, she had never yet met the 4th lieutenant. She presumed this either meant he didn't care that she'd jumped over him by defeating Vokan, or, more likely, he was waiting for the least convenient moment to spring suddenly out of nowhere and assert his claim. What she did not win, despite a virtuoso demonstration of ass-kickery that would have made Boba Fett, who had taught her most of it, pink with pride, was a single particle of Commander Jerdak's respect or regard. He was prepared to accept that she was useful after that display, but if anything, he seemed to resent her even more because she had proven to be so. On the rare occasions when they had to deal with each other, he never failed to go out of his way to insult or belittle her, and she knew for a certain fact that he had induced at least 4 of the bigger and or more skillful ratings to try their hands at putting her in sickbay at various odd times. It was a strange way to run a starship, B'Elanna thought, and it hadn't taken her long to become weary of it. Zarg had warned her that she would have to fight for her place, and she was okay with that. It was the Klingon way, and for that matter, it wasn't far off from the duelist way either. But all the time? That was getting tiresome. Under the Articles of War, there was only one way for an incompetent captain to be removed from his command, other than by an Admiralty court-martial back on Klingon Prime. The one exception to the article forbidding combat to the death among a KDF starship's officers held that a ship's first lieutenant had the right to challenge the captain for his post and his life if the lieutenant felt the captain's conduct was endangering the vessel's worth to the fleet. In practice, though, that justification was fraught with ambiguity, and it would take a bolder first officer than Subcommander Caradus to make the attempt. Not that Caradus was a coward by any means, but she lacked the bare-knuckled, bloody-mindedness that such a challenge would require. She was a modern, professional soldier of the new school so much disdained by Jerdak, more inclined to quote from her extensive knowledge of the military history and theory of 100 different cultures than to draw a blade and sink it into a lax and laggardly superior. She was the only Klingon B'Elanna had ever known of who spoke Latin, but being able to quote Cicero in the original wasn't going to pry Jerdak's repellent bulk out of the center seat. In the meantime, Jerdak's disdain for his exec's professionalism and his battle engineer's standing meant that the junior-most officer and many of the ratings, taking their cues from the captain, barely managed to pretend that they respected either one. Weapons Officer Vokan, in particular, having learned that he was never going to be able to win his seniority back in a fair fight, would, B'Elanna was sure, almost certainly stoop to some illegality or another in his next attempt, at which point one or the other of them would most likely get seriously hurt. A good captain would put a stop to the matter before it came to that. Jerdak, on the other hand, was probably hoping it would happen. I'll tell you something else, a visibly drunk Commander Jurdak declared at dinner during B'Elanna's third week on the Hwachat. If I had my way, Battle Engineer, you wouldn't even be an officer. And do you know why not? When B'Elanna didn't reply, the captain grinned, showing his filed teeth, and said, It's not simply because you're an undersized cuvaletta. He paused again, to give her an opportunity to react to what would have been an insult leading to an automatic death challenge coming from anyone other than her commanding officer. First Officer Caritas gave a disapproving cough and busied herself with her dinner. Second Officer Tlamach looked uncomfortably around the room, wishing, as he often did, that he could be anywhere else. The fourth officer was, as ever, not present at the table, and Fifth Officer Vokan didn't even try to stifle the bark of laughter the captain's remark elicited from him. When B'Elanna didn't take the bait, didn't acknowledge the remark at all, he smiled even more broadly and went on, It's because you're not a warrior. You're just a mechanic. In more civilized times, the Empire didn't waste commissions on the likes of you. Or lifeboats, he went on, his blaring voice becoming still louder as he warmed to the topic. On the Bird of Prey where I was an ensign, no one whose battle station was aft of Frame 82 had any way off the ship, and rightly so. If such things are needed in the first place, that means the mechanics have failed. Period. End of story. They have failed and their lives are forfeit. They shouldn't live. They shouldn't want to live. Jurdak knocked back some more blood wine, banged his empty mug down on the table, and roared, Bah! It's not fit work for a Klingon anyway. We should leave it to Kuv, as in the old days. He was slurring his words audibly now, his eyelids drooping. With an effort of will, he fixed his bleary gaze on B'Elanna and declared with the careful enunciation of a man who is very drunk making a point, Any man whose son tells him he wishes to be a mechanic should kill the boy and declare his line ended for the good of all Klingons. His seed has obviously failed. Then, satisfied that he had made his view of the technical professions perfectly plain, the captain fell into a heavy, twitching, slobbering sleep, leaving First Officer Caritas with the logistical challenge of getting her immense, unconscious, obstreperous if awakened superior to his bunk. That was the last time B'Elanna had taken her end-of-watch meal in the officer's mess. As she worked on the tertiary EPS junctions at the far end of Maintenance Conduit 239, B'Elanna wondered, for nothing like the first time, what General Tholek had been thinking of when he posted her to this ship. She had joined the KDF specifically to fight against the kind of pig-headed, pointlessly cruel atavism Commander Jurdak represented. She hadn't had this problem with her first Klingon commanding officer. She and Commander Krug of the Baranga had been of fairly complementary temperaments. Krug was Krontap of the Khoskaja's less ambitious elder brother, a man who so delighted in commanding a small ship that he had refused promotions because they would have taken him to a larger one, and he was a particular fan of the way the duelists of the IPS Valiant did business. Under his command, she'd proven herself in battle and risen swiftly from Beck to Lieutenant, earning her officer's commission by swinging a mean wrench for a man who, although not a technical officer himself, appreciated the good a well-swung wrench could do. In that, as in so much else, Jurdak was virtually the diametric opposite of Krug. The man ran his ship the way her uncle Klavor had run his family back when she'd had the misfortune to be part of it, with a combination of intimidation and casual cruelty. The old times he kept lamenting the passing of, which B'Elanna knew had passed long before the fool was ever born, were times best left dead. And yet here she was, a half-breed engineer on a ship captained by a man with a deep and abiding hatred for non-Klingons and technical personnel. Was this Zarg's way of teaching her a lesson? showing her that he'd been right when he told her she should wait for the IPSF to get into the fight in earnest, then make her contribution as a member of Uchinatencho's crew? She knew he was a cunning and ruthless enough negotiator to think of such a strategy, but she couldn't quite bring herself to believe that he would do it to her, not after he'd borne personal witness to her uncle's cowardice and savagery on the day she had ceased to be a Clavar. If not that, though, why? Did he simply not know what a blackguard Jerdak was? She doubted that even more. It would have taken a fool of a general indeed not to notice that the Hwatcha was the worst performing bird of prey in the 7th Fleet. Besides, Jerdak and Zarg's chief of staff had seemed to know each other quite well, and whatever Kratak knew about the officers of the fleet, B'Elanna was sure the general knew as well. Was the war situation so desperate that commanders like Jerdak, whose crews were dull-eyed and without cohesion, who avoided combat whenever possible unless the odds were overwhelmingly in their favor, who generally went out of their way to do the minimum possible, were tolerated as being better than no commanders at all? B'Elanna sighed to herself and got on with welding up the last of the junctions. Strategic and logistical considerations of that kind were none of her concern, and she could do nothing about them from the literal ass end of a Koloth-class bird of prey that was pretending to patrol Area 449. She looked up, her face suddenly thoughtful, as something in the vibration of the ship's structure around her changed. Reaching to her belt, she tabbed her iPod to pause, then dialed the ambient sound attenuation, usually kept at 33%, so that she wouldn't be entirely deaf to the outside world while listening to music on these off shifts. Off altogether. Yes, that wasn't her imagination. They had dropped out of warp. And what was more, they hadn't cloaked upon doing so. What was going on? There was no battle alert sounding, and it was unlikely that they'd run across anybody who needed fighting out here. That was why Jerdak had chosen this patrol area, after all. And even if a Clavarite ship had appeared on long-range scanners, she'd have heard the captain called to the bridge on the intercom, after which Jerdak would have found some excuse or another not to engage. Besides, the ship wasn't throttling up for battle. B'Elanna could see the status of the entire power system from here, and none of the relevant systems were engaged. The shields weren't even up. Her first impulse was to leave the J-tubes and go investigate. Her second, hard on the heels of the first, was to stay in the J-tubes and investigate, a revision the prudence of which was demonstrated a few moments later, when metallic clicking and clattering noises came to her ears, carried there by the structure of the ship itself. Docking clamps. Right, stay in the J-tubes, B'Elanna, she told herself. And instead of crawling to the nearest exit, which opened into main engineering, she opened an access hatch above her head and started up one of the diagonal shafts instead. Red Claw Squad came aboard on Deck 3 forward, where the officers' quarters were. Through a tertiary emergency hatch most members of the ship's company thought hadn't worked in decades, unopposed. Indeed, entirely ungreeted. Lieutenant Krek found this unsatisfyingly anticlimactic, but he had been briefed to expect it, and his satisfaction did not enter into the mission planner's calculations. The arrangements for this operation, as with all Red Claw's operations, were made on a level far above Krek's, and it was not his lot to wonder about them. He and his men, distinctive in their red-trimmed Imperial Navy armor, moved with quick, quiet precision through the Hwatcha's quiet, empty corridors. The ship was on its night shift at the moment, just as they'd been told, and with its stripped-down patrol crew, virtually no one was about. As per the briefing, the ship had been locked down by command override prior to their arrival. If any of the sleeping crew happened to wake and decided to go for a stroll now, they would find their quarters locked and their intercoms unresponsive. They could burn their way out with their personal weapons, eventually, but by then, Krek and his squad would be long gone. Following the path they'd trodden in training until it became instinctive, the squad moved off down the corridor and climbed the ladder to Deck 2 portside. This was a lonely part of any bird of prey, the part of the ship where, crammed in underneath the sloped armor of the main hull's arching shoulders, the compartments were low-ceilinged and strangely shaped, unsuitable for much of anything other than storage. Only one member of the crew of the Hua Cha was quartered on 2 portside, assigned to the ship's most remote, least desirable quarters, and as far away from her duty station as possible, as a token of the captain's esteem. Without waiting to be commanded, Technician Radath used the codes he'd been given during mission prep to override the lockdown on the door of the battle engineer's quarters, and the squad swept through in a precise, perfectly drilled formation, ready to neutralize and secure its prey. In training, they had gotten this down to such an exact science that their simulated quarry seldom even woke up. That would be a particularly good outcome. She would find herself on Kronos, having no idea where she was or how she'd come to be there. The Emperor would, Krek felt sure, be especially pleased by that. This time it didn't go that smoothly, for the simple and straightforward reason that Belana Lontai Clavar was not in her quarters. Krek and Beck Desit barely realized this in time to stop themselves from pumping stun-setting disruptor bolts into her empty bunk, which would have been a useless, noisy gesture and, in the absence of its occupant, might have started a fire. The Beck glanced in surprise at his commander, one eyebrow arched in a question. Krek nodded and held up his hand, fingers moving apart, in the silent command to commence a contingency plan. Spread out and find her. The 5 members of Red Claw Squad put that plan into action, 4 of them departing down the ladder back to Deck 3, while Desit stayed behind to search the storerooms and miscellaneous systems closets of Deck 1 and 2. They had no particular sense that their mission had started to go wrong. It was annoying to have to search the ship, and would take them some extra time, but it wasn't a critical failure. The Hua Cha was a small vessel, and it wasn't as if their quarry knew they were hunting her. They'd still be able to bag her and get out long before the ship began to wake for the changing of the watch. In the starboard engineering support lab on Deck 4, Belana watched the 5 untagged life signs start moving apart and considered her options. She was alone and unarmed but for her Daktag. Weapons were clumsy things in the workspaces, prone to getting snagged on things, and she had no idea what the situation was up forward. The ship's internal sensor web wasn't responding forward of the main hull. For all she knew, that meant another group of intruders had taken the bridge. The simplest thing to do would be to cancel the security lockdown, open every door aboard the Hua Cha, sound an intruder alert, and let the matter sort itself out. Upon investigation, she found that whoever had emplaced the lockdown had secured it with a command-level encryption. This console wouldn't be able to break something like that. It was a simple diagnostic station. It wasn't even really supposed to be able to access the intra-ship sensors this way. That was a snag in the plan, but not a fatal one. In fact, it was an opportunity to test a thing she'd been tinkering with for weeks, having devised it against just such an eventuality. With a cold little smile, Belana shut down the maintenance console and powered up her secret weapon instead. Well, all right. Technically, her Quartec Model 2408BR Omni-Tool wasn't a weapon, but the Omni part could stretch an awfully long way. Right now, she set it to work on the lockdown encryption, running a variant on a Kurotama icebreaker adapted for general cryptanalysis by fellow duelist Shuri Takatsuki, then opened up a hollow window and patched the tool into the Hua Cha's internal sensor web so that she could keep tabs on the intruders' positions while she considered Plan B. One of them was now up on Deck 1 starboard, poking through the storerooms. 2 were working their way along the port and starboard corridor branches on Deck 3. The other 2 were on Deck 4, passing through the cargo holds en route to main engineering. Switching the Omni-Tool's display to passive mode, B'Elanna jumped and swung herself into the support lab's ceiling structure, then worked her way forward and entered the upper J-tube. She was the only member of the ship's crew small enough to enter most of the really tight crawlways, which were ordinarily serviced by remotely operated drones. Fortunately, she had no particular fear of enclosed spaces. Working her way forward, she came to one of the ventilation gratings, affording a partial view of the engine room. After a few seconds' wait, she got her first look at one of the intruders. He was a Klingon male, big and brawny, but lighter on his feet than the most hardcore bruiser types. Wearing a streamlined armor type she'd never seen before, recognizably a product of a Klingon military research lab, but lighter and sleeker than the standard marine equipment she was used to seeing, and trimmed in red. He carried a disruptor carbine and had a target assist optic fitted to his right eye, and his bearing was alert and professional. This was not your run-of-the-mill boarding party Beck with all the subtlety of a falling rock. Some kind of commando, specially equipped and highly trained. Great. B'Elanna lowered her Omnitool's display density to its lowest setting, so that its holographic user interface was a barely visible ghost around her left hand, and used it to record a holo of the man in his gear. Then she moved carefully, quietly, away from the grating and started heading forward again. At the next junction, she switched to a vertical shaft and climbed up to Deck 3. There, well away from any vents or access panels where the glow of her Omnitool wouldn't give her away, she rezzed up the full interface again, cleaned up and enhanced her hasty holo of the commando, and started a visual recognition search on his equipment. Her icebreaker showed only 5% progress. Plan A was apparently going to take a while. Switching the tool back to passive mode again, she looked around to get her bearings, then entered one of the transverse shafts and started making her way amidships. This route would take her through the ceiling of the mess hall, which ought to be deserted at this hour. From below came the muffled sound of a challenge, delivered in a low but harsh voice, and for a second she thought she'd been made somehow. But then another, even harsher voice answered it, and B'Elanna realized that one of the intruders had encountered a member of the crew, someone who, like her, hadn't been in his quarters to be caught by the lockdown. She heard the whine of a disruptor. The harmonic told her it was set to kill, but not disintegrate. Another point in favor of the idea that these guys were serious professionals. Only cowboys and people with a statement to make set their disruptors to disintegrate. The pros knew level 7 made the target just as dead for only 2/3 the energy draw. She reached an access junction and cracked the hatch, hoping to get a look at what was happening down there. After first shot, the disruptor had fallen silent, but from the noise, it didn't seem as if the fight was over. A moment later, another man in that same red-trimmed armor, slightly larger than the first one she'd seen, staggered into her narrow field of view, his face bloody and wearing a look of extreme surprise. He raised his hand to his ear in the instinctive gesture of a man activating a comm link. Another, even larger figure in the distinctive red-trimmed uniform of a KDF science officer loomed into view, his back to B'Elanna. He made a sound, not the challenging roar of a Klingon warrior, but a harsh, guttural hiss, as he seized the commando by the neck, hoisted him clean off the floor, and then slammed him against the forward bulkhead. Aboard a Federation ship, the blow would probably have propelled the man's armored form clean through the wall, but Klingon vessels' internal structures were more heavily constructed. The commando gave before the wall did, his arms going limp and falling to his sides. With a low snarl, the massive shape gave his decommissioned foe an experimental shake, then discarded him like a broken toy and turned to look up at the access panel. With a faint thrill of surprise, B'Elanna saw that he was a Gorn, a member of a Saurian species from... she forgot exactly where, somewhere in the constellation Lacerta. She had heard of Gorn, but never seen one before. They had their own little space empire somewhere off Corward of Klingon space, and as far as B'Elanna had ever known, stayed there. Ilana glanced at her Omni-tool and saw that the other intruder on Deck 3 was heading forward again, vectoring toward them. She opened the access panel the rest of the way, swung herself out, and dropped lightly to the deck. Keeping her voice low, she said without preamble, "This guy has teammates, and they must be chipped because one of them is heading this way to investigate why this one just dropped off the net." She bent over the sprawled commando and reflexively gave him a once-over with her Omni-tool in medical scanner mode, dead, before removing a small device from his wrist. Working quickly, she turned the comm link over, removed the back panel, and took a small golden rectangle of circuitry from within it, then closed the cover again and replaced the device on the dead man's wrist. Without opening it again or trying to use it, no one would be able to tell it had been tampered with. Straightening up, Bilana turned to the slightly bemused-looking Gorn and said briskly, "We have to get out of here." If he were surprised at her sudden appearance or inclined to argue with her instructions, the Gorn gave no sign of it. In fact, he inclined his head in what she could only think of as a cordial manner. With one eye on the indicated positions of the intruders, Bilana toggled open the mess hall's forward exit, then led the way quickly aft through the galley and into the cook's storeroom. From here, they could exit in any of three directions, depending on what the investigating commando did after he found the body. They watched warily as he bent over the corpse, scanned it quickly with a tricorder, then straightened and put his hand to his ear, reporting in a low voice on his discovery. From their vantage point, Bilana and the Gorn couldn't hear what he said, and the response from whomever he was talking to was inaudible. The conversation took only a few seconds, whatever its substance. Then the commando went to the door Bilana had left open, looked warily out of it first one way, then the other, and slipped quietly out, heading forward. Bilana and the Gorn retired aft in consequence, leaving the storeroom and darting across the corridor into the officer's briefing room. Bilana made certain the enemy signals were all well clear of the room for the moment, then turned to the Gorn and said quietly, "Battle Engineer O'Brien, you must be the mysterious fourth lieutenant I've never managed to meet." The Gorn's liberally toothed mouth quirked in what would have been a wry little smile on a human. Saluting her with fist to chest, he said, "Kai, the engineering officer. Her surmise is correct. The one reports for duty." Bilana considered him for a moment, then nodded. "Well," she said philosophically, "you're too big for the J-tubes, but you're handy in a fight." She powered up her Omni-tool and keyed in a command. Part of the user interface divided itself off into a small blank area, slightly raised from the rest, like a stage. She placed the golden wafer she'd taken from the commando's comlink on it, whereupon the Omni-tool dismantled it in a little play of golden light. The Gorn raised a brow ridge. "That's interesting," he said. "Did your holo device just assimilate that encoder chip?" Bilana nodded. "Mm-hmm. Deresolved its molecular circuitry and incorporated the pattern into its own holographic matrix." She fiddled with a couple of settings, then smiled. "Which means I'm in their comms now." "Five reporting," came a voice, accompanied by a flickering spectral analysis in another small holo window. "Decks 1 and 2 are clear. Proceed to Deck 6 and search the deep engineering spaces," another voice replied, the cool, clipped tones of someone accustomed to being in charge. "Be advised, however, that the target is not the only active hostile. 3 is dead, and whoever killed him is a lot bigger. Action." A pause. Then, crisply, "Acknowledged. Acting." Bilana looked up and met the Gorn's eyes. "Well, now I know they are, in fact, after me," she said with a lightness she didn't altogether feel. "Hmm," said the Gorn, and then, with a hint of sardony, It must be stimulating to be so sought after. Huh, Bellana replied. She switched to a different display, this one showing a partially completed status bar. 44%. Okay, new plan. We have to get to the secondary computer room next to the captain's quarters.
Lead the way, said the Goron with another gracious nod. You're the one who knows where they are, after all, he remarked, indicating the tracking map Bellana had pulled to the front of her Omnitool's display again.
They moved quietly forward, keeping well to the sides of the corridors and darting from doorway to doorway. This part of the ship was clear of hostiles for the moment. They were all down searching decks 5 and 6, but they might come back up here at any time, and neither felt it prudent to be anything but completely alert.
What do I call you?
Bellana inquired, her voice almost inaudible, as they slipped through the mess hall again.
I am the Science Gorn, replied the Gorn matter-of-factly.
Bellana paused and glanced back over her shoulder at him. Do you have a name? She wondered.
Yes, but I find it is largely irrelevant in my current employment, the Science Gorn replied. Klingons cannot pronounce it, and in any event it is superfluous. I am a Gorn science officer. There is only one in the KDF. The designation is sufficient.
Okay, said Bellana, mentally filing it with the many other things she didn't have time to concern herself with at the moment. Making their way back up the ship's main body to the secondary computer core was a slow, tense business. Using the tracking information from Bellana's Omnitool, they were able to avoid the boarders who were clearly sweeping the ship for them, or perhaps more accurately, for her, but it required more than a bit of doubling back and slipping down side corridors. By the time they reached the compartment, Bellana could feel the back of her neck growing stiff with tension, and the jangle of nerves that told her the spike of adrenaline she'd been running on was beginning to fade, leaving an aching fatigue in its wake. Silently, she motioned the Science Gorn to one side of the door, waited for him to get in position, and swept her Omnitool over the lock. The harsh electronic blat of the lock releasing seemed deafening, but there was no resulting change in the search party's positions, or any sign that the local override had been detected by whomever was on the bridge. Motioning her colleague through, she covered the Gorn before backing into the compartment herself, then locked the door behind them.
If we're lucky, she said, they'll assume the original lockout is still in force and we'll have a few minutes to figure out what's going on.
Meanwhile, she went on, powering up her Omnitool's full interface again, I can use a couple of these sub-processor clusters to speed up my icebreaker. See what you can find out about the status of the ship. The Gorn inclined his head in what she thought was probably approval, then turned to the computer core's access console. After a few moments of surprisingly delicate typing with his impressive talons, he leaned back slightly with a hiss that seemed to mix surprise and a bit of dismay.
It seems the bridge has been sealed off by someone employing the captain's personal authorization code, the Science Gorn mused. The full intruder protocol is in place. Blast doors sealed and the bridge access corridor vented to space.
That slightly sardonic tone returned as he looked over at her.
The one suspects they are not in the mood to entertain visitors.
Bellana gave a humorless laugh as her icebreaker signaled the completion of its task. Immediately, most of the red blocks marking closed-off functions cleared to the usual orange. With her way into the command systems open, she started pulling up what information she could from the ship's administrative log files. According to this, the last entry in the operational log was at 1533 hours KST. Second Lieutenant Klamach logged the captain on the bridge, and an order to change our course and speed.
After that, nothing. The science Gordon consulted his own findings.
Internal sensors report two life signs at the bridge at that time. Then a high-energy event consistent with disruptor fire at 1534, and only one life sign thereafter.
He glanced at her again, one brow ridge raised.
One would say this makes the subsequent happenings relatively clear. It was after those events that the ship dropped out of warp, then permitted the enemy vessel to come alongside and dock.
Yeah, I'd say it does. Can you get a visual on the other ship without tipping them off?
One moment.
The science Gorn plied his console, then made a satisfied rattling sound in his throat as the view from the ship's docking camera appeared on his display. Toron assault shuttle, or close enough. It looks like it's had a few modifications done. Bellana mused at the sight of it. Those things have a relatively small operating radius when loaded up with a full boarding party. They must have a larger ship nearby to support it.
Impossible to say for certain until we have access to the high-resolution sensors, said the science Gorn, but the basis of your supposition is sound.
All right, well, we'll burn that bridge when we get to it, said Bellana pragmatically. Turning to her Omni-tool again, she rezzed up a plan of Deck 4, then overlaid the security command system over it, clearly displaying the areas still under security lockdown in blood violet. She smiled darkly as she changed one of the locked compartment icons to a neutral amber. That should disable the comm lockout on Caritas's quarters. Let's see about getting her out and then figure out how we can take back the bridge. Tapping into the internal comm network, Bellana opened a viewer connection to the first officer's quarters, but her intended greeting died in her throat as the screen's camera pickups came online. Caritas was still in her quarters, apparently engaged in some entirely characteristic off-watch reading given the book open at her desk. But the Mechleth blade protruding from between her shoulders made it very clear that she would not be answering her comm or anything else, ever again. Or not, Bellana mused. The science Gorn's voice was thoughtful.
Our strategy seems clear at this point.
Bellana felt her eyebrows rise as she turned to regard him. It does.
With Klamach and Caritas terminated, you are now first officer, said the Gorn officer with implacable logic. It therefore falls to you to challenge the captain for control of the ship.
Somehow I don't think the Klavarites are going to be terribly mindful of the legalities at this point, said Bellana wryly.
Indeed. But if you can gain command and release the system lockdowns accordingly, it becomes far easier to use the ship's defenses in repelling the boarders, and any surviving loyal crew may be brought into the fight.
Such as they are. Bellana pulled up her schematic of the Huacha again, tapping her finger thoughtfully against the section now open to space, which showed in black. The bridge access corridor on Deck 5 is hard vacuum at the moment.
Correct.
Bellana stood in silent thought for several seconds, the beginnings of an idea visibly forming behind her face. Then, turning back to the science Gorn, she asked, "What's the status of the ship's weapons?" The Gorn tapped a foreclaw against his scaly chin, then queried the computer.
"The ship is still configured for patrol standby. Disruptors are cold, and torpedo targeting systems offline."
"But the torpedo system's machinery is live?"
"I believe so, yes."
Bellana nodded. "All right, I think I may have an idea, then. If I head for the bridge, do you think you can prevent Jerdak from getting reinforcements once I arrive?" She was almost certain that the expression on the science Gorn's face was his equivalent of a smirk.
It is often the second lieutenant's duty to entertain guests.
After making sure the corridor outside the computer core was clear, they exited the compartment, heading to the junction that would send the science Gorn down toward the main corridor, while B'Elanna turned in the opposite direction. All right. Give me about 10 minutes to make my way down to Deck 6. From there, I'll probably need 5 more to hit the bridge.
I will be prepared.
All right, then. Science Gorn? Am I really supposed to keep calling you that?
It is sufficient.
B'Elanna couldn't help but laugh softly as she made her way stealthily down to the next J-tube access point and began her descent. On Deck 5, her luck was good, and there was no sign of any boarders. But just before the Deck 6 junction, her Omni-tool vibrated against her arm, the tracking display rezzing up to show that one of the commandos, 5, if she remembered the earlier conversation correctly, was still on Deck 6, and right in the way of where she needed to be. Leaning back against the tube's cool wall, she pulled up her deck plans again, then integrated the sensor web inputs to show the commando's position. He was smart, and had set himself in the main accessway, with clear arcs of fire to every possible approach. His disruptor beam rifle could cut her down in less than a second, long before she could reach him, even if she were mad enough to try taking an armored special forces operator hand-to-hand with only a Doctog. Okay, so there's no way I'll be able to take you head-on, B'Elanna mused under her breath. But maybe I don't need to. Switching to her command override program, she took a quick look at what was available after their work in the secondary computer core. Weapons, navigation, shields, and engines were still locked down. She probably wouldn't be able to clear those until she was able to get control of the bridge. But that left quite a few non-essential systems that she could put to use. Simply shutting down gravity control would be too obvious, and would almost certainly bring the rest of the boarding party. Overloading and detonating the nearest EPS conduit to the intruder's location was how they would do it in an action vid, but in real life it would black out half the deck, definitely alert the bridge, and probably not actually work. But the power doors... that idea had possibilities. A quick sequence of commands brought up another layer to the map, this one showing the location of each door. Reaching out with her free hand, B'Elanna carefully drew her finger across the access doors around the glowing red dot. The icons flashed as her glowing fingertip crossed them, changing from standby amber to activated red in a carefully described pattern. From there, she swiped all the way to the border of the deck plan, or, more accurately, to the transfer airlock that normally was used to load supplies for the galley. As her finger swiped over that final icon, a flashing red message popped up over the map. Caution. Airlock main cycle override. YN. Smiling darkly, she tapped to confirm the override, then double-checked the sequence of doors being activated or released to make sure she had everything lined up. Satisfied, she took a deep breath, then punched the flashing commit icon. Redclaw 5, otherwise known as Technician Radath, was vigilant, well aware that their quarry could decide to make her way down to his position. But after the better part of an hour standing in the middle of an empty deck, he had to admit that he was also quite bored. That changed when the power doors on every side of him suddenly snapped shut with a harsh growl of servos. He raised his disruptor rifle, preparing to burn through them. If their target had triggered the doors in hopes of trapping him, she would have an unpleasant surprise. These were not blast doors, just the normal interior kind. None was strong enough to stand up to more than a few seconds of sustained fire. Before he could pull the trigger, however, His attention was seized by the sound of doors rapidly snapping open to his right, and an odd whistle, highly pitched, almost as if... Whirling, he turned just in time to see the final door open, and the explosive decompression of the compartment yanked him off his feet before he could magnetize his armor's boots to the deck. His rifle flew from his fingers as he was blown toward the star-shot blackness of space. Shoved violently down the corridor by the force of the air relentlessly escaping from the Huachat's interior, Radath was slammed against door jams and hull frames as he bounced along the impromptu disposal chute. Though the Klingon body had evolved to absorb quite a lot of punishment, particularly from blunt force trauma, it still had limits. After the third collision, Radath's vision was a mass of stars that had nothing to do with the open airlock. After the sixth, he was unconscious well before his body flew into the void. Which was probably just as well. Ilana watched the red icon fly down the corridor and finally off the map. "So long, Screwy," she muttered, unconsciously quoting one of the antique cartoons B-6 Security Chief Garibaldi was so fond of. "See you in St. Louis." A moment later, the airlock was sealed once again, and a new set of doors opened once the deck finished repressurizing. Tabbing open the J-tube hatch with her foot, Bailana dropped to the deck, then ran flat out along her newly cleared route to the torpedo magazine. It wouldn't be long before the remaining commandos realized that their buddy was off the board, and she needed to be elsewhere by the time they made their way down to investigate. Her goal wasn't the magazine itself. The only thing a photon torpedo would be any good for in this situation was one of the more epic breeds of murder-suicide, and Bailana wasn't anything like that desperate yet, but rather the machinery of the magazine. Specifically, the transfer system which carried the weapons from their heavily armored storage compartment, just abaft the ship's neck, up to the automated launcher in the lowest level of the head. As she considered the magazine's master situation monitor, Bailana found herself reflecting on what a stupidly designed system this was. Oh, the transfer aisle itself was a straightforward enough solution to a problem, namely that there wasn't room in the ship's head for the torpedo storage, and the location was too vulnerable for a properly fortified magazine anyway. But both magazine and launcher were on Deck 6, and Deck 6 wasn't connected between the main hull and the head. It was below the level of the neck. The torpedoes had to be lifted by one elevator to the transfer aisle on Deck 5L, a half-height crawl space between decks 5 and 6, and then lowered by another into the torpedo tube's autoloader mechanism at the other end. Why, she had wondered since first reviewing the ship's specifications, introduce two superfluous points of potential failure into one of the ship's most critical combat systems? Did someone realize very late in the process, possibly even during construction, that they had screwed up the alignment of the transfer aisle such that they couldn't make the torpedo magazine or the launcher line up with it? Was any shipwright really that sloppy? She considered the insane profusion of power couplings down in primary impulse engineering, and the woefully divergent deck plans of every other bird of prey she'd ever seen, and reluctantly concluded that the answer was probably yes. "Well, as long as it works, that's all I care about right now," she said to herself, and then activated the torpedo delivery unit's maintenance mode. The workings of the machinery sounded terrifyingly, deafeningly obvious to Bailana, since she was standing right next to it, but there was nothing for it now. A glance at her omni-tool showed that the three remaining red dots were up on Deck 4, working their way forward, but even if they'd heard the noise, she'd be long gone before they got here. After a few moments, the TDU, a slightly curved metallic cradle about the size of an enlisted crewman's sleeping rack, designed to hold a single Mark 14 photon torpedo, arrived on the track in front of her. It was empty, having been instructed by the maintenance cycle to skip actually collecting a weapon. Now she interrupted the programmed loop so that the carrier stopped in front of her. As she climbed onto the TDU, B'Elanna reflected wryly that, for once, the Klingon military's near-complete lack of a safety culture was working for her. Back in the Federation, she'd have had to override at least a half-dozen safety systems designed to prevent anyone from doing what she was about to do. Here, all she had to do was climb on, grab the retainer rails that were meant to lock into the torpedo's underside, and try to make herself as small as possible. "I hope this works," she thought, and then cut out her interrupt. It was, unsurprisingly, a violent ride. The designer of the Koloth-class's TDU hadn't given any thought at all to the G-loads the device's cargo would be subjected to, since any such loads a mere mechanism could impose would be nothing compared to those a photon torpedo experienced in the routine course of its duties. Worse, from B'Elanna's point of view, was that there was not a single speck of lighting anywhere in the closed part of the system. She hadn't considered that before undertaking this crazy scheme, but it made perfect sense once she discovered it. Why would there need to be? No one was ever supposed to be in there, and if someone did need to do some emergency work on the system, they would presumably be equipped with work lamps. She wasn't completely in the dark, thanks to the glow of her Omnitool. The holo interface's orange light cast weird, flickering shadows across half-seen, half-imagined rib structures and metallic surfaces as B'Elanna streaked along the inside of the transfer aisle, giving her the giddily fanciful image of being swallowed, or, she supposed, regurgitated, by some giant mechanical beast. She kept an eye on her position indicator, so she wasn't taken completely by surprise when the TDU slammed to a halt at the end of its track, then dropped underneath her. B'Elanna rode it down, reminded irrelevantly of the scene in that old Earth movie where the man rides an atomic bomb. More appropriate if there was a torpedo here, surely, though if there had been one, there wouldn't have been room for her. And braced herself for the violence of the stop at the bottom. When it came, she threw herself sideways, hoping she had remembered correctly which side the autoloader arm swung in from. It wasn't going to move, because the torpedo tube was already loaded and the TDU operating in maintenance mode, but if she'd gotten it wrong, she was about to slam into the massive, unyielding mechanism with considerable force. She hadn't gotten it wrong. Crashing to the torpedo room deck, she rolled and jounced painfully for a few feet, and then plowed into the bulkhead, knocking what remained of the wind from her, but she'd had enough room to lose enough speed that she wasn't actually broken by any of the impacts. Still, that hadn't been her favorite ride of all time. B'Elanna lay there for a few moments, catching her breath and wondering ruefully whether it was really too late to rethink this join the KDF thing. Then, recovering herself with an act of will, she dragged herself to her feet and switched her Omnitool to hand lamp mode. More weird shadows and strange angles surrounded her. This was an area less completely inimical to crew presence than the transfer aisle, but still seen seldom enough to be unfamiliar and intimidating. She climbed the emergency ladder up through the ship's master computer core on deck 5L. This was a tempting target, but she didn't stop. She knew well that there was no actual interface on this level, just the core itself. And short of opening access panels and starting to monkey-wrench the internals, there was nothing she could actually accomplish directly there. Since she wanted to use the ship once she'd taken it, she wasn't about to start doing that. Instead, she climbed straight through and up to the access hatch leading to Deck 5, the bridge level. This did not open straight onto the bridge, fortunately, but rather in the corner of one of the service corridors alongside it. The consoles lining the walls of the ship's control room were designed to be serviced from the back, and to this end there was a service corridor on each side. She was on the port side, behind the tactical station. To get to the bridge proper, she had only to go forward a dozen paces or so, hang a right, and step out from between the communications and navigation stations. The captain's chair would be almost directly in front of her. B'Elanna would have preferred to make a somewhat stealthier approach. particularly given that she knew the captain had a disruptor, and she had neither a beam weapon of her own nor a body shield. That wasn't an option, though, unless she wanted to dismantle the tactical station and crawl out through where its main display had been, and she suspected even Jerdak would notice if she started to do that. Instead, she readied one of her Omnitool's trump cards, drew her Doctog with her free hand, and prepared herself. "Don't underestimate Jerdak," she cautioned herself. "He's a fat, lazy slob who hasn't been in a real fight in years, but he's still a Klingon, and he's much bigger than you. Remember what Boba taught you. Fight smarter, not harder." Then, her face grim, she strode out onto the bridge.